Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb, and I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be here moderating today's webinar on fighting declining RPC, or right party contact rates. Collection agencies and creditors have been fighting a losing battle, it seems, against right party contact rates for years. Fewer consumers are responding to letters and answering the phone when it rings. But alas, all is not lost. There are still plenty of opportunities for collection agencies to get in touch with consumers. Today, we're lucky to be joined by a panel of industry executives who are here to share their insights and strategies into combating the fall of RPC rates, or stemming the fall, maybe. I'm excited to also let everyone know that this webinar is being sponsored by Microbuild. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net for the few of you who haven't heard me say this before. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Tracy Dudek is the Chief Operating Officer for State Collection Service and is responsible for overseeing the organization's production and support areas, including the company's extended business office and third-party collection divisions, as well as patient engagement, business intelligence, client services, and human resources, among others. Tracy has been involved in the receivables industry for more than 20 years. She has been instrumental in enhancing the technological tools that put State Collection Service ahead of many others in the healthcare receivables space. Additionally, she has played a key role in the growth of State Collection Service's multiple locations. Mike Hiller is the Vice President of Collections for American Profit Recovery. He joined APR more than a decade ago as an entry-level employee. He is a licensed collection manager in Michigan and serves as a subject matter expert for the state's Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Kelly Parsons O'Brien is the President of Pacific Credit Services, formerly known as Credit Bureau Associates. Kelly's a third-generation debt collector and has worked for the family business for 26 years. She has a passion for collections and has spent most of her career working with the collections department and helping collectors reach their best potential. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and once it is concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I just want to ask everybody to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen when the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow. So if you're not doing anything on a Saturday afternoon, you can fill it out then as well. Participating in the survey helps me develop the content that's what you're looking for and find speakers like the ones we've got today who are the people you want to hear from. With that, let's launch into the discussion, and let's start maybe with a little bit of a benchmarking opportunity, and let's ask and go around and get each of the panelists to maybe share some context or some data to sort of establish if, and if so, by how much have your RPC rates declined this year, say, compared with 2018. And since Mike Hiller's face is on my screen right now, Mike, why don't we give you the honor of going first?
Thanks, Mike, and it's good to be back. So our effective RPC, so we weighted against hours worked and staff and RPCs proper, but our effective RPC rate is down 5.3% year to date. So that kind of gives you a benchmark of what we're looking at. Now, taking in context, our revenue and profits are up. So what's the lesson, right? Our RPCs are falling, but our revenue is up. And I think really the moral for us, insofar as this year is kind of unfolded, is to focus on what makes a quality RPC. So focus on what you can control, and that is quality contacts. And I think that's going to be tantamount to success as RPCs more than likely will continue to decline.
Excellent. Thanks for the information. Kelly, I'm going to hear from you next.
Thank you. So ours are down just a little bit, but what was really interesting, and I think to Mike's point, was to talk about, you know, the quality of the right party contact. So when I was looking at some of the data to compare to 2018, although the numbers were down a little bit, I realized that we weren't really great as a company really qualifying a right party contact. So sometimes the collectors talk to the same person several times in a day, and that was counting, you know, the right party contacts up. I was also noticing that, you know, the collectors were labeling a right party contact, even if the consumer like said, oh yeah, this is John, but then hung up on them. So I really thought that at least I made a list for my training manager who does some of our technical stuff, like our stats. And I said, we need to get better at figuring out who we really are actually talking to, and then why are we talking to them? You know, how many calls is it taking for us to talk to them? So I think for us, at least from this webinar, is to go back to the drawing board and really start tracking them a little bit differently than we are now.
Great. Thank you very much. And Tracy? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay. We have had a similar experience related to tracking right party contact rates as you have, because we found in our early out division, and we're predominantly healthcare, that we really use a button on the screen to tell us whether it's a right party contact or not, which is agent driven. So it's, boy, I don't know, it's as good as the people that are pressing that button. But in any case, in our early out division, our contact rates are up 320%, which is a huge number. And I'm just going to qualify that by saying that it's all about the mix of business and the geography that we have added over the last year. So when you look at your rates, you have to also look at the individual clients or geographies that you're working. So we had a major change, and that's because of the mix of business change in early out. In our third-party collection division, right-party contact rates are actually up 9% from 2018 to what we've experienced so far in 2019. So that's a good sign for us to have those right-party contact rates up.
So then, Tracy, I had a question. So, like, when your right-party contact rates go up, does that have something to do with, like, maybe some type of skip trace work you're doing, or maybe a new vendor to get better phone numbers? Because that was one of the things that we were looking at, is if I change a vendor for my phone numbers, I often will see a bit of a change because my data is better, right? And I also noticed that, like, depending on the type of business I'm working, the clients that are referring accounts more quickly to collections, my right party contact rate goes up because, you know, that data is better. We do a lot of ambulance debt collections, and the right party contacts are awful in that arena, but it's also because this information is just not good.
Right. Oh, yes, absolutely. It goes up with skip tracing efforts. We did not necessarily have a major skip tracing initiative or change over the last year. I think more what ours was driven toward was the client consent to call, or the implied consent. I think our clients are getting better at getting the consent on the front end and being able to pass that information to us, so that we have to do less manual dialing in order to obtain a consent, and more auto dialing, as well as a higher answer rate with local phone numbers being used where we can do that.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Excellent. Mike, I want to go back to something you mentioned, and I don't know if it's a different data point or if it's just context, but you were talking about this idea of a quality RPC. Is that a different data point, or is that just a different way of looking at RPC?
No, it's a different way of looking at RPC. So it's the same data point, but focusing in your training and continued development with collectors, how you define a quality contact. So it's not so much there is or there isn't, it's a different statistic, as how can you create quality and make the most of that contact? Look, we're going to close 77% of everything we collect the first time we ever speak with someone. It's hugely important for us to make the most of that initial contact, if you will.
Got it. Okay. A question that's come in so far, and I'll use this as an opportunity to remind everybody who's listening. If you have a question for our panel, please type it into your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll get to it as quickly as we can. Okay, the question is, your RPC rate is down, as is most everyone else's, but you're up in revenue, though. Is that due to better RPC conversion, higher payments when you do convert, both, or something else?
So say that one more time.
Yep. So your RPC rate is down, as is most everybody else's, but you're up in revenue. Is that due to better RPC conversion, higher payments when you do convert, both, or some of, you know, none of the above, something else?
Yeah, so I mean, we are seeing slightly better conversion rates. I think that has to do mostly with tenure. So our retention rate is looking really good for the past year. So we have more collectors that have more experience, period. As I mentioned, we're also spending more time in training up front, but then continued development. So continuing the training with your collectors, even though they have 6 months or 6 years of collection experience. And then finally, really, I think it comes down to the way we work our accounts. And I don't mean monumental changes, but systematically looking at where we're spending our time and is our time better spent in other places. And what I mean by that in the simplest form is scores. So we have our internal modeling and then we also use an outside vendor and we couple that information together. And now our vendor is able to offer scores on every account, regardless, you know, of Social Security, date of birth, et cetera, because they use all these demographic modeling points. So we have scores on everything now. And in the simplest terms, we're just spending more time on more valuable accounts, but doing it in a very incremental and strategic way.
You know, I'll jump in as well. We use scoring definitely to help set some of the call cadence. So yes, to find phone numbers or to tell you which accounts to work, but then also going that step further to say, all right, now when should I call these accounts in what intervals? And we use a combination of outside vendors for that information as well as our own internal historical view of when we've had success talking to that consumer in the past and, you know, how many days can you let go by on a promise to pay that gets broken before somebody needs to be prompted as a reminder, how many days to make the first call. So we do differentiate those strategies based on our client's geography and the scores.
That's awesome.
Okay, excellent. Let's change gears a little bit and let's look more forward looking. You know, with the release of the proposed debt collection rule from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, one of the key components of that was a call cap provision, limiting the number of times that you can attempt to call somebody and the number of conversations you can have, with certain exceptions, of course. I'm curious to hear from each of you on what effect you think the call caps proposed by the CFPB are having on RPC rates, or looking at it differently, there are states, you know, Massachusetts being one, that has a call cap limit already in effect. If you can talk to, you know, any calls or any attempts you're making in states where there are call caps and how that impacts your RPC rates. Kelly, would you mind going first?
Not at all. So we don't call in any of those states. And, you know, I don't know that I was the best person to start on this question. I was more curious what some other people had to say, but you know, 7 times in 7 days, it didn't seem unreasonable to me. I mean, I know that there's probably some accounts that should be called more often, and maybe there's reasons, especially like as Mike and Tracy talk about these scoring and telling you when they call. I guess what I'm curious is, like, if you're calling somebody 20 times in a day, are they more likely to pick up the phone and talk to you than if you're calling them, you know, 5 times in 7 days? So I guess I would be a little bit curious, maybe from the rest of the group, as to what results they're seeing, because we're calling people regularly and, you know, some of them more than 7 times, sometimes less than 7 times. And I don't know that really calling them more times is really getting them to answer more often.
I agree with you. And actually, in preparation for this webinar, I had a conversation with our business intelligence analyst, and he said, listen, and I'm going to quote him. He said, if I previously called somebody who wasn't home 8 times a day, which we don't call 8 times a day, but if you did, and now you're only going to call that person 1 time a day, your right party contact rate is going to improve just by virtue of the mask, right? So he said the measure that's going to be important going forward is maybe not the rate, the RPC rate, but the number of RPCs per accounts that you have in your portfolio. And he said, you know, he thinks that, that the metric for us needs to change. We always, you know, we see the number of RPCs, but we don't really look at how that changes or unique RPCs, meaning talking to people for the first time would also be another measure that he thinks is going to become important.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Tracy and Kelly. I think there is some nuance, and I think it is going to depend on what the final ruling looks like. You know, Massachusetts is a good example. We have a fair amount of business in Massachusetts. And I can tell you that, you know, there's a difference between, okay, 7 calls in 7 days, but is that 7 calls to 7 different numbers in 7 days? Or are you picking up an account, calling all the numbers you have every 7 days? So Massachusetts, specifically, when I talk a nuance, is per dial, not per account. So if you have 4 numbers for an account, you can't call all 4, obviously. So there is a difference there, and it's going to depend on what actually comes out of the CFPB ruling. But I can tell you that we're leaving some money on the table in Massachusetts, specifically because of the call restrictions. Our liquidation rates aren't as good in that state in particular.
Very interesting. Well, at this point, I just want to pause the discussion briefly and talk for a little bit about the sponsor of today's webinar, Microbuilt. For more than 35 years, Microbuilt has been helping businesses assess and manage risk. They were a pioneer in the now exploding alternative credit data space, and as such have refined their products and services to deliver true business value. Over the years, Microbuilt has invested heavily in acquiring best-in-class data. They've built sophisticated systems for keeping their data fresh and accurate, and powerful predictive models for making decisions around lending, leasing, collections, and risk management. With Microbuilt, you can customize the products you need and how much you want to spend. And all their products are provided through a single, simple access portal. Whether you're working in originations or debt collection, screening a potential hire or tenant, planning for growth, or keeping up with regulatory requirements, Microbuilt can be your partner, providing the insight and information you need to protect your business, grow your bottom line, and keep your company running smoothly. For more information, please contact Microbuilt at 1-800-884-4747 or visit www.microbuilt.com. With that, thanks again to Microbuilt for sponsoring today's webinar. Let's resume our discussion. I'm curious, with respect to RPC rates, is that strictly limited to phone calls, or do you look at return letters and, you know, can email and text messages, I guess, is another way, other channels to look at. Can email and text messages help boost RPC rates? And if so, by how much? Tracy, would you mind going first this time?
Sure, I can do that. We implemented a texting solution, which is really a tool that we use, not widespread. We stepped in very in a small way, but it was pretty fun. We did it during tax time, and we still are using it. And it's when we talk to the consumer over the phone, we can give them a phone number and tell them that they can text 474747 and the word pay, and they can then get a link to our portal and make a payment. And so in that very, that's our only experience with texting so far on the third-party collection side. And consumers do use that feature. We get people texting the 474747. They make a payment. It still is less than 1% of the payments that we have, but it is another tool and a way to reach the consumers. Also, through that way, we're building a database of email addresses and phone numbers where we have consent to text, so that when we're ready to roll out a larger solution, we'll start using that consent and have some other features for gaining it through the people that sign up on our web portal as well as verbally. So I do think it will boost RPC rates, and it just makes you easy to do business with by offering people the solution to pay that's easiest for them to make the payment.
Tracy, do you put that on your letters, the text option?
We do, yes. Yep. Yeah, and you know, related to email, that was the other part of your question. We do email with consumers in a limited way when the consumer wants to initiate a dialogue with us through email or gives us, obviously, consent to email. We do email statements once we've received the consent for that. And, you know, people can then self-serve on our portal. And, you know, we get this auto mail that comes in every day and says, hey, look, these are, you know, all the people that made a payment and completely self-served. And it's growing. And for us, you know, it pays, you know, the equivalent, you know, the revenue we get is about the equivalent of two collectors through those e-pay options right now. So we're happy about that, but it's not, you know, it's not a large impact yet, but we think it will grow.
I also thought, like, for text messaging to boost right party contacts, maybe, like, you know, with your solution, Tracy, you have all this permission to text people. And as we might need to change our outbound phone numbers to get people to answer the phone, maybe sending a text message like, hey, we're going to be calling you from this number, pick up, talk to us. So I kind of wonder if there's a way to communicate with consumers that, like, hey, we've changed our number, here's what it'll be, give us, you know, pick us up when you reach us. So I kind of thought about maybe a way to get people to pick up the phone if you're telling them you're going to be calling them.
Oh, that's interesting. We had not had that discussion, but I think that's a great brainstorm. I just think, you know, the texting capabilities open up a whole new way to communicate, and people want to communicate that way, so why not?
Well, and, you know, and I have a credit card with Chase, and they always send me a text message saying, like, hey, your payment's due in 10 days, and which I really appreciate, and I make sure it's scheduled with bill pay. And then what's really nice is once they've posted it, they send me another text message and say, hey, it's posted. And, you know, I think especially for, like, our regular payers or people that are truly trying to resolve their accounts, creating this environment that we're more like a financial institution and not some big bad debt collector is really going to be key for us to continue to kind of change the image of debt collections and then also be more successful as an industry.
Yeah, you know, along with the ability to send a receipt electronically is a big customer satisfier, or consumer satisfier. And, you know, in the old days, we used to not want to send a receipt. You know, we tossed that off. You can get it on your bank statement because we don't want to spend the money to send another letter to just say, hey, you got your, you know, your payment went through. But now we offer a receipt because we can send it electronically. So, yeah, I agree. The practices are changing.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Kelly. It's just a better customer-centric focus. You know, we're not heavy into email or text. We're not. But I certainly do think that, you know, as this gig economy starts to grow, and the, you know, the immediate gratification of you buy something online and they confirm it, they tell you when it's shipped and tell you when it's at your door, is really what we can expect to see moving forward.
Well, I can't tell you, before we did text and email for, like, confirmation of payments and consumer statements, I can't tell you how many irate callers I had to do a second talk off for because they just could not understand how we couldn't possibly email them this information. Everybody else does it. And yeah. So that really changed it for our office. We don't have to have that argument, which takes up staff time.
But, what do you mean you can't email? It's 2019.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does blow consumers' minds.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Now, have you guys seen, as far as letters, the effectiveness of letters, have you seen that fall?
Yeah, I mean, I've always, my speech on the first few days of training has always been, letters don't collect bills, collectors collect bills, right? But I also think that there's definitely still a population of people that are responding to the bills. Right now, we still send a first notice before we start making phone calls. But I really think that that may change in the near future for us. I find the early out, we're sending our first notices, we're sending our notices, but I think that for the third-party stuff, I really think that it might be a better solution for, as we're making contact, we're sending those letters. I don't know. It's back and forth. A lot of people say I haven't received your letter, right? You get that 90% of the time. And so, especially if we have email and text capability, well, let me send it to you right now. Let me send it to you while you're on the phone. You can verify you received that validation notice and we can move forward with this call. So we send the letters, but sometimes I feel like it's a check, a check I waste every month.
Yeah, I hear you there. Our the effectiveness of our letters are kind of following the RPC rates. And Tracy, just out of curiosity, have you seen the same thing with letters, the effectiveness of letters?
Yes, we send the statements or the letters out that we have to, and in some very targeted, tax time or settlement campaigns, but beyond that, we try to send as many e-statements as we can, and then just manage, the bounce backs or whatnot. One thing we are undoing, maybe you're both ahead on this one, but our e-statement is this flat image, like it's not interactive today, and one of our goals is to get that statement a little more interactive, so it's got some links that you can click on, and just make it more user-friendly and launching to the portal being that flat file. So I don't know if either of you, when you send an e-statement, are you doing some direct linking back to the portal? And if so, have you noticed any increase in consumers going to the portal because of it?
We don't. That is a terrific suggestion.
Yeah, and we're not doing much e-statements. Most of the emailing and texting we're doing right currently is more like closed, closed accounts, or in the event that the consumer is requesting something. So they're on the phone, they haven't received something, or let me text you a statement of your account so you can look at it, and then there'll be a link to the payment. But we're looking to change our online process. So we are in the middle of redoing our website and then setting up a better, more interactive website for them to make payments, set up payment arrangements, things like that. Because I think that's one thing that we're a little behind on, and making sure that, they can go to our website, they can make their payment, but I think they want to have more control. And that's what I'm hearing more often, is the consumers really want control of their finances, including their debt collection finances. And so I think we need to get on board with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see a question that was typed in, and I'd love to start the conversation around that. And the question is, how impactful to right party contact rates do you think phone numbers being incorrectly flagged as scam or scam likely is having? And I think it's a huge impact. Not only do I think it, I've got some data that I'd like to share. We participated in a benchmarking study with some other agencies, and they surveyed all the phone numbers and our phone numbers along with others, and found that overall 9% of all the phone numbers being used by the agencies were scam likely or fraud. 36% were marked as high risk, meaning that people had said they were a nuisance call or suspected spam, which is where a lot of our phone numbers fall in. 21% said it was a medium risk, and a medium means it's a possible telemarketer or debt collector, and 34% were a low risk. I was very interested to see where our individual numbers compared with other companies. The numbers I just shared were for the whole study that was completed. And, I think it is having an impact. There's no doubt about it. And then the question is, well, what do you do about it? Because you want your right party contact rates to go up. And there's some companies out there. I don't get anything for saying this, but, we've partnered with Numerical to do a full phone number study and contracted with them to do some active management of phone numbers. with the carriers and, you know, really changing them from getting them changed from suspected spam to not be suspected spam, as well as there's a company out there, First Orion, which we have not signed up for the service yet. However, there's some analytics they have that show that about your answer rates can increase by about 70% when you're displaying the number and company name on your caller ID. So, you know, I think there's some partners out there, and there's other ones probably beside Numerical and First Orion that may help, and it might be a fit for your individual business, and they may be worth talking to, because this is a complex topic, and there's companies that just dedicate all of their time to how you get listed at the carrier level and what happens between the national carriers and the local carriers. And I see that somebody asked to give the name of the companies. This is Tracy, and Numerical is the company that we did contract with, and First Orion is a company that we've talked to about a product they have called Enhanced Calls related to increased right party contact rates. And there may even be others out there.
You know,
Mike, I hope I didn't just violate some rule or something by saying those names. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. No worries. Tracy, am I just coming to ask?
Well, I just was going to mention, and I think one of your questions, Mike, was about changing our phone number. And that was kind of one of the ideas that many people in the agency or industry have had, is just keep changing your phone number. But we were finding that it was causing problems with our people that we were communicating with. So what was happening is we had changed our phone number, but the people that we had already communicated with, that we had already set up arrangements or set a follow-up date with, what was happening is they weren't answering our calls. So these people that we'd already been building relationships and building rapport with were missing our calls, and then we'd leave a message and then they'd call us back. And they're like, oh, I didn't know it was you. I didn't have, you know, I had your old number saved. This is a new number. And so, you know, although it may help us with the new consumers, I'm really concerned about how we handle our existing consumers that we're dealing with already. And I don't know if anybody has any ideas.
Yeah, I'll comment quick. Just that we don't have a number rotation strategy per se, because we tried it, and it was pretty rough, because the phone numbers that were marked as suspected spam got relabeled as suspected spam, some of them within 3 days of changing to a different phone number. So I think it's more important what you pulse out on the caller ID. And then also, so we're pulsing out the local phone number that we use when we're using a local phone number call, just because of the name of our organization. And then in our early out area, we're pulsing out the name of the healthcare facility. And those calls are getting answered quite well. So, you know, I think it's a dual strategy of getting it fixed at the carrier level and then working on the caller ID versus rotation of phone numbers, because I would imagine it does exactly what you said. You know, the people you are working with regularly don't know you anymore, and then 3 days or a week later, you just get put back to suspected spam anyways. Every single phone number we tested in that strategy got put back to suspected spam within 2 weeks.
Interesting. Thanks.
I'm also curious, because along with this, you know, the carriers noting calls as scam or spam or scam-likely things like that, you know, the SEC just did, issue a declaratory rule that grants carriers the right to automatically block calls they deem to be robocalls from being connected. And I'm curious if you think that that's going to have a detrimental effect on RPC rates as well.
I'm sure it can't help.
<Go ahead. laughs>
Yeah. I had 8 calls from myself yesterday. It popped up, Kelly O'Brien on my caller ID 8 times yesterday. And so I think we're all fed up with the robocallers, but I think no matter what they do, they're really hurting legitimate business. And I think that that's really the issue here it's clear that nobody is able to actually stop the illegal robocallers. And so they're creating all of these things that, help consumers not be responsible for picking up their phone and answering it, right? Because of this nuisance. And I get it. We're all annoyed. But I also think that it's important for us to make sure that they're hearing us when we say that you're really hurting legitimate business. And there's definitely reasons why people need to call, for many reasons. I think about like blocking the number, but what if it's my kid's school or, all of these things, phone calls that I'd actually like to receive. So I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, it's an interesting. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tracy.
Sure. Yesterday there was a Shake and Stir Robocall Summit phone call or webinar from 9:30 to 3:30 yesterday, and you can find the information about that on the fcc.gov/Shake and Stir Summit website web link, and it says that they will be posting a video. Later a recording of that, but there a big section of the conversation yesterday was around the caller ID authentication framework and how to get rid of the illegal robocalls and get the good calls through. And we had some folks listen in on that webinar, and they came back and said our entire leadership team needs to listen to that webinar, get educated even further and look at the direction of where things are headed. So I guess I just wanted to share that. It just happened yesterday. So go ahead. I'm sorry for the interruption.
No, absolutely. That's good stuff. And Tracy, you and Kelly are both right. There is an interesting dichotomy, right? You get that call on your phone and you're frustrated because it's student loans or, your vehicle warranty is going to expire. And then you call a consumer and you get blocked and you're frustrated for the opposite reason, right? So we want our calls to go through, but not those spam calls. But a couple of the vendors that Tracy had mentioned do offer services that allow you to certify and register your phone numbers through participating carriers. So that is an option. And I think the more advanced that this technology gets, we're just going to need to get more creative and work with more partners on how to combat it.
So what you're saying, Mike, is we have to spend more money just to have people answer our phone calls.
We got to spend more money. You got it.
It's interesting. I was reading a recap of that summit the FCC held yesterday, Tracy, and one of the best quotes I saw, not the best, but the sort of one that kind of provided the best context was someone who said that they can block a phone number, but they have no idea what the content of the call is. And they're never going to be able to know what the content of the call is. And that seems to be the credit collection industry's biggest argument against, all of these call blocking efforts is that nobody, you're blocking calls just sort of on spec, and that's not necessarily the best way to go about it. So I do think that there's a lot of work to be done from the industry's perspective in terms of addressing this going forward, because it seems like between legislation and rulemaking, it is just going to get more and more restrictive in terms of the calls that are allowed to be connected between, someone who's making the call and someone who wants to receive that call or not.
And Mike, a little more introspection on what you said in terms of spec. So a lot of what these carriers are doing is, you're right, they're using metadata. So they're taking a look at how many calls a particular number is making. And then they're also looking at feedback from consumers who receive those calls, right? So the numbers that you're using on your caller IDs to make outbound calls, at large volume calls, you might want to think about recycling a little quicker than some of the phone numbers that you reserve, for other purposes.
Excellent. Well, to the point you made earlier, Mike, and I think everybody agreed with you, RPC rates have been declining for some time, but it doesn't really seem to be affecting the industry severely. We've had panelists mention that profits are up, revenues are up, even though RPC rates are down. So, you know, is the concern about, you know, falling RPC rates overblown, or is it maybe just something that, you know, everyone's just kind of got to be mindful of? And is it necessarily a harbinger of, you know, the end of the credit collection industry?
So to rephrase what you're asking, are we the proverbial frog in the pot of water?
Sure, something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I do think that we're going to need to get a whole lot more creative, whether that means working with vendors on phone numbers or working with, you know, some of the other avenues such as social media, text, email. You know, the various ways to communicate is changing. And it's changing fast. I mean, my wife is a principal at a middle school, and you've heard this, but she sees it every day, so I get to hear it from her. But kids aren't having conversations on their phone with their phone up to their ear. They're not. I mean, they're using their phone to communicate, but not in the traditional sense of the term that we think of it. So I do think that RPCs will continue to decline. I do think that letters will continue to be less effective. And I do think that we need to really focus on investing in some of these other ways to communicate.
I guess, you know, based on what we've discussed so far, I think I can answer this question, but I'll leave it to the panel. But if you had to choose, would you rather have the right phone number or the right address for somebody, and why?
I don't mind taking that first. So one of the things is, like, you know, phone number, of course, right? If I can talk to them, I can collect from them. But I was hoping you could give me the option of, like, maybe an address and an asset was another option. Because I think that that's the other thing that's happening. I can't remember whose article I read was the increase in debt collection lawsuits. So we've always been a bit of a heavy lawsuit agency. And so one of the things that I'm looking at is okay, so these people with these large balances are not answering the phone. They know that they owe, you know, $20,000 and $30,000. They're just not going to answer the phone. I think that our culture in general has a bit of a head in the sand mentality, right? If it's not in front of me, I don't really have to deal with it. And so what we're finding is that we're sending those accounts a lot quicker to our legal processing department than we ever have. Before we would call on them for, you know, 3 to 6 months, and now they hit that 90 day, and if we haven't been able to get one return call or any type of response, we're moving in that direction. And so I think that that's a little bit of a change for us. So I think, to answer your question, a phone number would be better than an address, but I also think an address to serve somebody and an asset to pursue is not a bad option either.
I'll take an add-on also. I'd like the phone number with the consent to call that phone number. I pick phone number because not only can we call the phone number, we can text to the phone number, we can direct drop message to the phone number, and possibly we can initiate a text that might lead us to a chat or being able to deliver an e-statement. So I still think the phone numbers very important, but agree that the methods that we use to communicate via that phone number may not be the verbal conversation that we've all traditionally had.
And Mike, I say of those two, I would prefer a Twitter handle. No, I mean, I say that tongue in cheek, but like any truly good sarcastic remark, there's an ounce of truth, right? I mean, so right now, phone number. But you might want to ask me again tomorrow, because I can tell you that my opinion changes when the facts do, and the facts are changing quickly.
And you mean facts, F-A-C-T-S, right? We're not talking about facts. We're not introducing that into the conversation, are we?
That's a great example of something antiquated.
One of the things you mentioned before, Mike, that I wanted to follow up on that I thought was really interesting was some of the other areas of a business that impact, you know, the RPC rate. And you were talking about retention rates and training and continuing education. And I'd like maybe if you could spend a minute or two and just sort of expand on, you know, how those different areas actually impact, you know, RPC rates, and how you can sort of use those areas to maybe maintain or keep your RPC rates from falling off a cliff.
So I guess the best way to kind of further explain that is by, you know, zooming in on the microscope. So if we use, you know, one example as sort of a case study with regards to RPCs and, you know, having more tenured collection staff, I think it really comes down to the term RPC, how you're defining that. So for instance, when you call a nearby, right, and you leave a message, well, what if the bill gets paid immediately following that message? Is it coincidence? Well, you're not going to know unless you, you know, look at some statistics behind it. But what we see is you're more likely to collect it if you leave a message. You're more likely to collect it if you speak with a third party and they take a message for the consumer. And of course, you're more likely to collect it if you actually talk to the person at a proper RPC. But what are some of those things that kind of hang together with the result of getting a payment? And so in training and with the more experienced collectors, you know, they're going to talk to a friend or family member. They're going to be able to get them to take a phone number for the consumer. They're going to be able to get them to either reach out via text or via the phone and have the consumer call us versus, oh, it's a wrong number, hang up, okay. Well, that's fine if it's a wrong number, but what if they know the person? What if they can get them a message? So really making the most of not only right party contacts, but making the most of your collection calls in general. Every communication you have, making it a little bit better. We live in the margins, right? We live in the margins, so we have to think in the margins. And anytime you can make a tweak to increase the odds of getting a contact, you increase the odds of getting a payment as well.
One of the things that we were noticing is our sense of, we do speech analytics and we monitor our sense of urgency. And one of the things that we were looking at is our sense of urgency goes up, like it was going up like 30% within the last week of the month. And it was so clear that the collectors clearly were trying to reach their goals and get to the highest point possible. But what I also noticed was we weren't really training on the sense of urgency. So we were training on, you know, they were doing their job. We're training on all the things that we do here, but we weren't really talking a lot about sense of urgency, and our sense of urgency dropped considerably right after end of the month. And so one of the things that we've increased is that sense of urgency is like, oh, well, if they tell you they'll pay at the end of the month, in your mind, you're thinking that's fine. As long as I get it before cutoff, it'll be fine. But if you're calling them a week before cutoff, you're like, no, I need it right now. And so that was one of the things that we worked a lot with our staff on, is trying to increase that sense of urgency to get the account resolved throughout the month. And that it made the right party contacts that much better because they were actually turning in, you know, they were converting them into payments.
So ours is similar. We've been spending more time educating the collectors and the early out representatives to resolve the account and giving them the tools they need to navigate the technology, because as much as they need to have a conversation about the payment or resolution, they also need to be able to help folks get signed up through the portal for an account, or so they can self-service in the future, or make sure that we have the consent. So there's this kind of IT help desk edge that now all of our traditional collectors and representatives need to have. And if they spend time getting the consumer set up through the electronic tools, that consumer will continue to use those tools in the future. We won't have to have a conversation because the consumer is already set up in the channel that they want to be set up in, and they're familiar with how to use it. So we've noticed a change in how we have to train the folks on the phone in order to help people with the changing technology.
Yeah, I love the idea of empowering the consumer to take responsibility and take charge like that. I like that.
Very good. I want to spend a few minutes now. We've talked a little bit about it, but with respect to texting and emailing and phone calls, but you know, what we now sort of call an omni-channel strategy in terms of communications and collections today. Just wondering sort of how, you know, if more consumers want to talk and if or communicate via text, And if consumers are looking for email, I know that there's a lot of people out there in the industry that are unsure how to go about setting it up or rolling it out or really kind of deploying it. And I'd love to get any feedback or advice or even questions that maybe agencies should be asking as this new frontier unfolds and before the industry and sort of see whatever information you're willing to share that you think might be, you know, informational or educational to the people who are listening now and to the recordings on this topic, if you don't mind. Tracy, would you mind going first?
Sure. You know, I think you can do two strategies. You can build your own texting platform or e-communication platform, or you can partner with people who've already done it. We've decided to partner with other providers that who offer this service. And so we've said, you know, we are not the subject matter expert on how to build that. We want to focus our time on, you know, how it will work for us and for the consumer versus the back-end technology that you have to keep updated. So we, you know, went down a path just like you would with any other vendor you're evaluating and talked and got information. And ultimately for us, have chosen a partner that has an integrated solution with our host software. So why we think that's a good answer for us is because there's some of the compliance features of, you know, how you capture the communication, you know, the dates that you communicate and the consent and when it's revoked and when it's given in a very easy manner. Now, I'm not saying you can't go build that out anyplace else, but we found it better to pull off the shelf and partner with somebody for a solution.
The other, we're doing the same thing. We partnered with somebody that links up with our software vendor. The other thing that I really, I shared with the panel was that this omni-channel strategy was kind of foreign to me. So when I was looking into it, the thing that stuck out to me, I think the most, is really about training our staff how to communicate by email, or if we're offering chat as an option, is how are they communicating? Is the consumer having the same consumer or customer experience that they have through text message that they would have if they called our office? At least our office spends a ton of time training our collectors on customer service, you know, defusing the consumer, all of these things that we do. And so I think as we move into this next future of, you know, maybe more interactive text messaging or a chat option, I think it's going to be so key for us to make sure that that customer service training translates, and it needs to translate into the written word. You know, when I talk, we've got all the inflection of my voice, tone, and that's lost in the text message and chat options. And so I think it's just really important for an agency to look at that and how are they training their staff? How are we responding? And then how is it being perceived by the consumers?
Very good, excellent. We've just got a couple of minutes left, so if anybody has any last-minute questions, now would be the time to type it in, and we'll try to get to it before the end of the hour. I'm curious. It seems to me, based on what we've discussed so far, and by all means, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, one of the biggest issues right now with respect to getting borrowers on the phone has to do with call blocking, you know, tagging phone numbers, that kind of thing. So I'm curious just to sort of circle back and maybe spend another minute or two on the topic before we wrap up. What advice can you share or insights do you have into, you know, maybe the best ways to sort of address this new dynamic in trying to reach people, if you don't mind, you know, to the extent that you're willing to share whatever you've seen work or maybe what doesn't work? Mike, would you mind taking that one first?
No, absolutely. Thanks. I do think, you know, there's always been a quasi state of paralysis in the industry simply because of the litigious nature. And you can't listen to a webinar or read an article without hearing about how litigious the industry is. And it's not that that's not true. It's just that we spend a whole lot of time talking about it. So I think that the more companies that get bold and start sending more text messages and start sending more emails and using omni-channel, because that is the future. You might be surprised when the lawsuits don't start rolling in. And I say that because I do think that this next generation and the one after it are just used to conducting their daily lives that way. And then from our perspective, I think that analytics is going to be huge with regard to right party contacts, with regards to omni-channel and the various ways you can communicate with consumers. I mean, take a look at what stockbrokers are doing with predicting stock prices and quantitative trading. We're not all that far off from artificial intelligence and machine learning being the next best thing. And it doesn't have to be, you know, displacement of collection staff. You know, it's not as if I think that artificial intelligence is going to replace everyone. I think it's just going to give us a wider variety of skill sets and different things that we can use to, yeah, get more people on the phone and collect more bills, quite frankly. But I think it's something that we can't be afraid of, and that we gotta face it head on and be willing to take some risks for and with each other.
Well, yes, I think, want to add it? Yeah, go ahead, Tracy.
Yeah, I'll just add, reduce your people cost and increase your IT and compliance budgets for 2020 and beyond so that you can do the things that we've been talking about and, you know, run a pilot with a vendor partner who can scrub your phone numbers and find a way to, you know, fix those phone numbers, or go, you know, dabble into the artificial intelligence. As you said, the call cadences matter a lot. And, you know, I always thought, you know, well, calling, yes, it makes sense. You can reach people more at night. But those things are changing. That's not true anymore for us anyways. We're reaching people during the day. We have to reach them in the channel they want. So we've got to anticipate where the consumers want to be communicated with and then have the processes set up to make it easy for them to communicate with us. And that's only going to happen by being out there and talking to the folks that are in this technology space that deliver different solutions, and then running a test and actually starting to do some of these things and see how they impact your portfolio. And then lastly, I'd say be careful that, you know, collection agency or agency A's solution may or may not be the best solution for agency B. So while you listen to others, you always test with your own portfolio.
Well said. We did get a question that came in. I'm not sure if anybody's doing this, but I do know some agencies are deploying using bots or virtual agents to interact with customers either through voice or text or chat. Are any of you currently using it or looking at it? And if you have any insights you can share? I'm going to guess those are three no's then.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know what, there's a little secret sauce that I might not be able to share here, but I'll just say that a client of ours has us chatting, not virtual chatting, but actually an agent sitting down and typing the chat messages back. And I was surprised how that chat feature has grown. 6 months ago when it started, it was maybe four or five a day. We keep two people busy doing chat for one client, and it's a healthcare client. So those tend to be more complex questions and situations, but I would say that chat will definitely be growing in the future. And, you know, related to virtual assistants and other kind of bot work, I think that we all need to be looking at that because, again, we shouldn't be spending the money on the people. It needs to be on the technology.
Yeah, we also don't use bots, but there is a blended environment where from the consumer's perspective, they're chatting with someone, but on the front end, there's an automation to it.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we've run out of time today, but before I let everybody go, I want to thank Mike, Tracy, and Kelly one more time for their insights and taking the time to share with us today. You know, they don't do this for any other reason other than to share and to help the industry, and I can't say thank you enough for their participation today. I'd also like to thank MicroBuilt one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. please go to www.microbuilt.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey when you get a chance. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, amazing job. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Bye.
I hope everyone has a great weekend. And if you're heading to San Diego for ACA's convention next week, I hope you have a safe and enjoyable trip. And we'll be back soon. Take care, everybody.